Welcome to Designed for More, brought to you by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Join Dr. Timothy Jennings, a renowned expert in psychiatry, neuroscience, and spiritual well-being, as he explores the connections between mind, body, spirit, and relationships.
Welcome to Designed for More, sponsored by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. I'm Dr. Tim Jennings, joined today by Danielle Rome, one of our therapists, and Dr. Carl Benzio, the Chief Psychiatric Officer here at Honey Lake Clinic. And today we're going to be talking about how to maintain your health or stay healthy in the face of conflict. And we have a lot of conflict that we see with our patients. What are some of the things you would recommend? And I think there's a couple directions to take this conversation. One is, how do you deal with conflict? How do we bring, say, reconciliation, if it's an important relationship that you have conflict? The other is, how do you maintain your health when there's conflict that can't be reconciled? Mm-hmm. I think both of those areas are worthy of discussion. Mm-hmm. But maybe we should start with the first, though. You've got conflict in a relationship, whether it's work relationship, family relationship. What are some steps, methods, principles that I would say godly principles to apply to conflict resolution?
Well, I want to start, I think we should define conflict, because I've talked to a lot of people that don't fully understand it. When they hear the word conflict, they immediately think of fighting or an argument. I've had patients immediately think it means actually yelling and fighting. That's their definition of conflict. The way that I see it is when there's two competing desires or needs that have difficulty coexisting in the same space. That's kind of how I've seen what the definition of a conflict is. But I don't know what you
mean. Thank you for doing that to help us define this to start with. I think that's a really good place to start. Conflict, because it can't. What do we want it to mean? It's we're talking at this point not national conflict, but interpersonal. Mm-hmm. No. Conflict with other people.
When two people have different ways of handling the situation, or they have different agendas, mm-hmm. right?
So conflict could be a conflict of different agendas. It could be conflict of interpersonal nature. I don't like you.
I don't like you.
Rather than, for instance, you and I like each other, but we have conflict on an agenda on what we want to do on a task. Mm-hmm. But we still may like each other.
Might have conflict of where we want to go out to dinner.
Yeah.
Or I thought I was going to get picked up at the airport, but you didn't pick me up at the airport. So we had different agendas of how we were going to solve a situation.
Yeah.
Some are infractions where there's sort of a moral breach in something, and there's a transgression, and we can talk about forgiveness and reconciliation. But sometimes there's just different ways of doing things or different agendas.
Yeah, let's not talk about the sinning against. Let's not do that.
Okay.
That's a wrong that's actually been done. Let's talk about when there's no wrong, but there's disagreement, there's conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Let's frame it that way, because I think it's a little bit different ballpark.
Sure.
Different tools that come to bear. We don't have to repent or forgive and these types mm-hmm. of things. Okay. So there's disagreement that's causing tension. What are some tools that we bring to bear to help that move forward in a constructive way?
Well, whenever I think of people on a continuum, to me, there's passive people that are only take into consideration the other person's needs, feelings, agenda, ideas, backstory. Then there's aggressive people, and there's passive people ignore their own.
Gotcha.
Then aggressive people only take into consideration their own needs, feelings, agenda, purpose, desires, backstory, and they ignore the other person's. So ideally, the assertive person is somebody who takes into consideration their needs, feelings, ideas, thoughts, agenda, and backstory. And they also take into consideration the other person's needs, thoughts. So when they come into the situation, like, well, how do we put all that information out on the table?
Is there a third group?
Which would be?
Somebody who is taking into consideration the calling, the mission of some higher authority or higher purpose. So it's not about my feelings. Jonah, I don't want to go do this. Is there a third group that is in conflict because they're trying to carry out a duty or a mission of a higher purpose that may not even correspond to their own feelings or the other person's feelings? Is that a third group?
Well, they're still their agenda, right? Their agenda is to honor God in the process. So they're incorporating that in their what they're taking into consideration,
okay. Yeah.
Or ignoring the other person.
But it's not necessarily about their feelings then. It's their agenda. Jonah didn't want to do it.
So it could be one of those elements, you know,
that
weighs into it, right? But they're considering their stuff and not the other person, or considering the others.
Right.
And so either one of those styles, the aggressive or the passive person, isn't going to be able to hear the other person or share their stuff. So in order for us to solve this conflict, we both need to be able to put our stuff on the table. Unfortunately, most people are raised in houses or situations where conflict isn't handled very well and in a very healthy way. But if you handle conflict well, the relationship really grows, because people are only in conflict whenever they have something in common. So the fact that we have something in common, but we disagree on how to do this one particular task, if we can solve this, then we can build the ability to communicate with each other, to share with each other, to be vulnerable and share what's sort of deep inside me with you, for you to share what's deep inside you with me, and for us to be able to handle that in a trustworthy way to come to a solution. And we get confidence like, wow, we can solve that. We can share, we can communicate, and our relationship gets deeper. For relationships that don't handle conflict, they sort of just go their separate ways and they leave. That's why a lot of, you know, romantic relationships, they're enthralled with each other. There's the honeymoon period. Everything is hunky-dory. We agree on all the same things, but whenever you find some things you don't agree on, instead of being able to manage that conflict and have some open, reasonable discussion about it, they either ignore it, or I don't want them to be disappointed or me. I don't want them to not like me. So you sort of hold back, you know, but that shows that you don't really trust the person. You're not really caring.
I want people to hear what you just said. I restate that last piece slowly.
Well, I don't know what the last
piece that if they're holding back to avoid hurting someone's feelings, is actually an evidence of not trust.
Correct. So they're not trusting the other person.
It's not an act of love.
Correct.
I want people to hear that.
Right. So
to avoid the conflict, the argument.
You're thinking you're loving the person by holding back, but you're not loving the person. You know, if we want a good, healthy, reciprocal relationship, I need to put my stuff on the table, and we want to do it in the appropriate ways with proper word choice, proper attitude, and proper motivation. But we want to be honest with them. And I want to elicit her.
So if Martine comes to you with a new dress that you honestly think is hideous and makes her look fat, I'm putting this out there because this is a real life
comment. It's just
okay. I can tell you what I do in my marriage, with the kindest words you can.
Yeah.
Do you share that truth, or do you pretend you like it because you don't hurt her feelings?
We try to be honest with each other.
That's right. I tell my wife. But here's how I do it in my marriage. I will tell my wife, if you love it and you want to wear it, I will support you in wearing it. But I want you to know, I think it makes you look 20 pounds heavier and you're not attractive in it, but you're free to wear it. Okay. I'm not going to tell you what to do, but you wanted to know how I see you in that dress. What it looks like.
And you want to be perceived by her.
And why are you laughing? You're like looking uncomfortable.
I don't know.
And this is critical.
Yeah.
Yeah. Your spouse cooks a meal, tries a new recipe, puts it on the table, and you really don't like it. Do you say honestly in some gracious way that you'd rather never see this on your table again? Or do you, because you don't want to hurt her feelings as a cook, you know, this is great, love it, and you're going to get it like every month?
And it's how you frame it. It's like, I'm not saying you're a bad cook. I'm just saying, based on my preferences, based on who I am, based on my
I prefer not to have
it. It doesn't agree with me.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? So you're not making a value judgment on her. You're just presenting from your perspective what you see. I'm not saying it's right. I'm not saying it's wrong. But this is just my perspective, the shoes that I walk in. Because I want her to trust me.
Yes, this is the
for
point.
My opinions.
Right.
So how whenever we have bigger things to deal with and I tell her something, she's like, is he lying to me just because that's what I want to hear?
Right.
Or is he actually telling me the truth?
And
it's a very important situation that we have to navigate and deal with.
And if you've been honest in these other things, you go, I love this dish. Or you look great in that. It has more meaning. But you are looking uncomfortable while saying this.
Well, I think there's another part that's important, and it's laying the groundwork of intention.
Mm-hmm.
I think that can really help build trust too. And also, if what you're saying does upset the other person, which is not your fault, right? It helps to be able to say, this is why I'm being honest, especially maybe in earlier stages of a relationship. So, for example, my husband has these t-shirts. That's kind of part of why I was laughing. I was thinking about my husband's t-shirts. I'm not a fan of them. And so it was really hard for me to learn how to be honest with that in a way that was helpful, especially earlier on in our relationship. But what was helpful is to say, I love you. You are so attractive. And I'm not very attracted to you when you're wearing that shirt.
Yeah,
but
fair.
But I adore you and I really want to feel attracted to you in the clothing that you wear. But, you know, if you love that shirt, I love that you're loving it and having a good time wearing it.
That's beautiful. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah,
you know.
And he'll respect you more.
Right.
He will respect you more. There's no question about it. Isn't that true?
Well, plus at the end of the day, you might have your feelings hurt in that situation, but as we sort of process it afterwards, we appreciate when the other person is honest with us, right? So that doesn't mean that we're like jumping for joy when we hear that proclamation by the other person, but we realize that there's a competing element of honesty, of transparency, of vulnerability, and I'm willing to share my true feelings and my true views with you because you're the one I want to be connected with and want to be valued by, and I want to, go this deeper, all through these layers to core relationship with each other. I don't want to just have these little superficial, relationship, but I want to be able to share. We're going to be in difficult situations in the course of our life, and we need to be able to rely on each other, that we can be honest, that we can be collaborative, that we can trust, that we can hold each other's feelings in ways and share those kind of opinions in ways that are open with what you are seeing, but cognizant of where I am too. So I can hear it, or at least receive it in a way that is consistent with what your heart is for me.
I want to see if I can maybe identify a common cause of conflict, particularly in marriage relationships, with male-female relationships. And I know I struggle with this, men tend to be, goal-directed, the hunter-gatherer type. See a goal, they go for the goal, and in a man's mind, it's processing the efficiency to have the outcome with the greatest score and least wasted resources to get the outcome you're looking for. Efficiency and achievement and accomplishment. Men get a certain sense of built-in, wired accomplishment, well-being from doing this. So whereas women in general tend to have a more prioritization of decision-making that build relationship, that find connection, that share experiences, not achieve the objective goal. So a shopping trip between a man and a woman, the man is going to think, where are we going? What is our mission? What are we getting? What are we going for? What's the list? And on the way there, he's navigating the traffic to see which lane is moving faster, where he needs to get to, whether you take that route or this route, because there's a backup over here. Because all about the efficiency, she's wanting to stop and take a detour to look at a house on the way. And he can tolerate that a little bit. But eventually they get to the store. And when they're in the store, he's already calculated his path through the store that's going to get him without having to backtrack to get all the things that he wants. And then when he comes at the aisle, he's looking at all the aisles to see which one has the bagger, so it's going to move faster, the shortest line, because it's all about the efficiency of achieving the outcome. Well, she's actually, as they're going through the store, stopping to look at this and say, hey, look at this. And pretty soon he's getting irritated. You're slowing down the mission. And she's like, I'm trying to share this great experience with you.
Yeah.
Okay. This is a classic male-female stuff that I struggle with. Because I struggle with it across the landscape of my life. Sometimes I'm on mission here at the clinic and I see I can see multiple steps down. I can see where we need to go. I can see the outcome that we need to get. And yet maybe other people have other little detours they want to take that are slowing down the mission, and I can get irritable. And I can sometimes feel frustrated and get snappy. I got to work on that. Okay. But this is classic male female thing, and it can be a source. And when I'm dealing with marital couples like this, I will suggest to the man, make part of the mission. You're going to take 15 extra minutes in the mission to look at extra stuff in the store. That's part of the mission. And then they can do, okay, I got, then part of the mission is 15 extra minutes of looking at stuff.
Uh-huh.
And then you build it in. Yep. Uh-huh. And they're not stressed by it because there is a frustration. It's normal, male or female. If you're trying to accomplish something, and as like a woman who's trying to cook a meal, if she's trying to cook the meal and somebody's throwing stuff in the recipe, she has to keep dumping it out and starting over, she'll get irritated because what she's trying to accomplish is being interfered with. Mm-hmm. It's just that the women are approaching it through the accomplishment is the relationship, so it's not being interfered with. The task isn't being interfered because that's the task.
The task is the relational connection.
Yes, is the task, right.
But so if we're not, feeling, not agreeing on this, on what the task
yes,
is.
Yes, exactly. But anything that would cause us to be interfered with, and as a therapist, if something is interfering with your ability to stay on time and you have patients backing up, eventually it's frustrating for you. So the dynamic of frustration when we're trying to achieve a goal is being interfered with is true for male and females. It's just different. We just approach what we're trying to achieve differently.
Well, what I see is there's conflict. We have different agendas that in your scenario, you're assuming that she knows exactly what the goal is, and she's assuming that you know exactly what her goal is, but there's not a communication that needs to happen. So what I've tried to do and what I've tried to teach is, I call it DESCA, DESCA. So it looks like de-escalate. So D is you describe the situation that is leading to the conflict. And I describe it, hey, based in the shoes that I wear and, you know, it, from my vantage point, I'm not saying it's the correct way to view it or it's the only way to view it. Here's what I saw happen, or here's where I see us having a struggle. Then I ask the other person, okay, you describe the event. Wow, I didn't realize that that's how you saw it or it was like that. Well, I really appreciate that. Or then E is for express your emotion. So what's the emotion that you have to let the... Now, again, I'm not saying this is the correct way to feel or this is the only way to feel, but whenever that situation happened, I felt alone or I felt not listened to or I felt that you're pushing your agenda on me. So try to use those I statements. So this is about me and what I'm saying. I'm not wanting to speak for you. Then I ask,
you made me feel.
Right. So, and then I asked, well, how did you feel? And I said, well, I didn't realize that you felt like that way. Boy, I'm sad that you had that kind of feeling. So then once we put it out there, a lot of times we assume that the other person knows exactly what the solution is, but they don't know exactly. They have their version of the solution. So S is specify the solution.
So what's the C?
D is describe.
Yeah.
E is express the emotion. S.
Oh, okay. I thought it was DEC. Okay,
yeah.
Never mind.
So S is specify the solution. So, hey, here's what I think would be a solution for the situation. What would you think would be the solution for the situation? And so sometimes there's agreement. Sometimes, hey, I want to tell you and you want, or I want to, you know, walk around the store a little bit longer. And no, we just want to get our goal and
get home to the Eagles game.
Get home to the Eagles game. So then after you put out your solutions and C is, well, what are the consequences if we continue to do it the original way? There's consequences to that. Well, what are the consequences? We don't trust each other. I'm going to be frustrated. I'm going to be irritated. I'm going to be trying to hurry you up in the process. And then A is, well, what are the advantages if we do that specified solution I have? And as you continue to go back and forth on the consequences and advantages, you guys are trying to zero in on what are the benefits to us in our relationship, our health, the organization that we're with, if it's an organizational thing, or with God, what sort of resonates with God's, you know, health plans for us in our relationship or how we're handling this particular
task. So I'm going to remember that, Deska. I really like that. I like that. I hadn't heard that before. I like it. Now I'm going to throw back a problem to you.
Yeah.
Okay. Because what you described will work well with generally reasonable and rational people who have disagreement. What happens to the person who is trying to use Deska, who is dealing with an irrational, emotionally driven person who's has a pattern of emotional-based decision-making that's not very logical or rational. And thus, every time you use DESCA, they go, it's always your way. It always ends up your way. And you're trying to use this psychobabble on me to manipulate me to get it. And you never listen to me because in fact, if you were rational, the DESCA would lead to the other person because it's a better decision. But the emotional person, how do they de-escalate when they're dealing with an emotional person who responds just like, you're just trying to manipulate me again to get your way?
Yeah. Hey, look, I want to, you know, we're obviously in a tense situation. I'm uncomfortable with it. You're uncomfortable. We need to find some solution. I'd like to find a way where you can share what's on your mind and heart. I can share what's on my mind and heart. We can put this information on the table in a nice, strategic, methodic way that 80% of 90% of what we need to know to be able to manage this conflict, we can get out on the table instead of you firing things out, me firing things out, you yelling this, you going back 10 years ago and 5 years ago. And in my childhood, I'm confused. I'm overwhelmed. You're confused. You're overwhelmed. We can keep that emotional volume down if we can be strategic in how we navigate this.
Trying to look at,
you know, one of the bigger things is that, you know, it's not, you're not my enemy, I'm not your enemy, okay, when we're in a conflict. Satan is the enemy, right?
Yeah.
And Satan has sort of removed himself from the equation and makes it seem like, oh, we're the ones on the opposite side of the line of scrimmage. You know, well, no, we're both on the same team. Satan's on the other side of the line of scrimmage. He's going to be blitzing us, so we need to get in the huddle. And if we don't get in the huddle and communicate and have some way of having a strategy to call a play, well, we're just going to go up to the line and Satan is going to keep on blitzing and attacking us. We're pointing fingers at each other. Well, you screwed up. I screwed up. Well, no, Satan is just laughing at us because we're...
No, but I want to intervene there because what you just said brought in the spiritual domain. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important because I think sometimes the overly emotional, rational person is more vulnerable to spiritual manipulation. Mm-hmm. And so maybe one therapeutic intervention, if it's minimal, would be to pause and pray.
Mm-hmm.
To pause and pray and ask the Lord's presence just to bring a emotional peace to both our hearts. And then I think I saw what you did when you turned to Danielle in the little like acting out. The example is you showed concern. And to express to the one who's emotional that your concern is for them and their welfare and you love them and you care for them. But
that's that assertive position of I want to express my stuff, but I care for you and I want you to express your stuff.
Right.
Right. That's important to me, who you are, what your needs are, what your feelings are, what those emotions are. Yeah, I see you're really upset by this. That's important to me. I want to acknowledge that, but we need to try to solve this.
Yeah.
So let's have some kind of strategy by which we can, you know, whether it's a script or whether what it is to make it easier for us to step through the paces that we can come to a solution, or else we're just going to spiral and we're on a hamster wheel and nobody's ever getting off.
I think there is truth in what you said, that sometimes there are unhealthy, evil spiritual forces that stir up very agitated and hurt emotions. Mm-hmm. For the purpose of causing division. And I think a real intervention that people need to remember. Sometimes I haven't always remembered dealing with people, but I will tell you, sometimes in my practice, I've had patients get really enraged, agitated, emotional, and I'm in real time praying. I'm not praying out loud with them, but in real time, I'm saying, Lord, send your spirit to this room, bring calmness. If there's any evil forces here, just put a hedge of protection around us. I'm actually having that conversation in my head. Mm-hmm. With the Lord.
Yeah, we want to bring that emotional volume down for us and for that patient so that the thinking volume can go up.
Yeah.
Because if we're just emotional volume, well, we're not thinking clearly and, you know, emotional.
So I think that's a real good intervention. I'm glad you brought that spiritual piece in because it's not always just. But there are some people who are emotional. You know, and this is just reality. There are some women who get monthly severe mood swings. Mm-hmm. They do.
Yeah.
Severe to the point that they actually become irrational and it's hormonally driven. Mm-hmm. And so just wisdom would be, to the degree you're in relationship, you know, that if it's not being medically managed well, that big conversations and decisions are not had during those times. We just love and understand and give space until things calm down. Conversely, I tell a lot of my patients and in my lectures that late at night is not the time to get into deep sleep because the prefrontal cortex fatigues through the day. And the prefrontal cortex is that thinking part. And also, even when it's not thinking, it sends a calming signal but just a general calming tone down to the mood. So you're just a calmer person when you're rested than when you're fatigued. When you're fatigued, you're more moody. Even if there's not a conflict, you're just more more likely to be moody and respond. So I tell spouses anyway, if your spouse tries to bring up a big issue late at night, and you're really tired, to express, that's important to me. You're important to me. I love you. But you deserve my entire brain, not half my brain.
That's good. Yeah.
Yeah. And let's sleep on this and let's have this conversation in the morning because I know I'm fatigued right now. I can't focus and I'm likely to be irritable and I don't want to say things that hurt you.
Yeah.
Rarely does that get a negative response. Mm-hmm. So those are some skills and tools. Other things to help navigate, and we're going to transition very quickly here in a minute, but Navi, anything else you want to suggest as a tool that people could use to help bring resolution in their conflict? You've done some great ones already. I love them, but anything else?
Well, I do want to add that.
How about the Christian principle? Yeah, I keep going. You know, talk to the person first.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And so this is what this is based on.
Yes.
Yeah. How to go to the person, but go to them strategically.
Yeah.
Right? To give them a sort of a roadmap or a script that allows them a confidence that, because most people aren't trained very well.
Isn't that a biblical principle?
Yes.
Yeah, to go to person one-on-one. And so to, you know, have a way to be able to go to them and say, hey, there's an issue between us. There's something, we have different agenda. We have some conflict.
My feelings have been hurt.
I care for you. I want to honor God in the process. Let's sit down and figure it out together. I have a way that we can sort of put that information on the table so that we can have a format that allows a more soothing process to occur instead of me yelling stuff out, you yelling stuff out. We don't really know what's going to happen next. That makes it easier to sort of inflame those emotions and become an emotional decision maker, which then distorts our ability to hear the other person clearly in the process.
So why didn't Jesus do that with Caiaphas? Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin had been plotting against him. He had clearly had a conflict with his brother in his race. Mm-hmm. But I'm not suggesting in any way Jesus did something wrong. Mm-hmm. I'm pointing out that there is times and circumstances, and I want, but Jesus did not actually go to Caiaphas and said, I know we have an issue. I'd like to work this out with you.
Yes.
How come?
Whether he had, you know, knowledge of what was to come or what his heart is and, you know, where Caiaphas's thinking was at that time, was he amenable? They had past interactions in the process to be able to get to this point and maybe had those discussions and had those opportunities in the past to have.
But he also said, don't cast your pearls before swine, lest they turn and rend you asunder. Okay. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I'm pointing out a principle that,
yes,
that if you have reason to believe that the person who has conflict with you is actually committed to be an enemy and will use what you're going to say to hurt you further, and they have no openness to actually have reconciliation, that was Caiaphas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you have reason to believe that, then going to seek them and having the conversation may actually fuel the conflict and make it worse.
Yeah.
And so there, so I think that's wisdom, discernment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
actually around the direction I wanted to go, is sometimes you can't resolve it. Right. Sometimes you can't, and sometimes you shouldn't try. And that's the importance of using wisdom and considering all factors of the situation, what you know about the person, and protecting yourself. And I heard it said to live peaceably with all means to not live with some.
Oh, I like that. No, that's true. That's discernment. Right.
Yeah. And so I don't know if that came from somewhere, but I heard it passed down in my, you know, family, but
several of the truths. I like that. How about this one is a principle also. There can be two good-hearted people have Christ in their heart and they're true to the Lord, who are a terrible match for marriage partners, for instance. They because of personality differences, likes and dislikes, and they're neither one's in rebellion against God, but just because somebody loves the Lord doesn't necessarily make them a good marriage partner. And then conversely, if you extrapolate that out, not everybody who's a committed Christian is somebody that wants, you know, is an outdoorsman, wants to go skiing and wants to do skydiving. Somebody might be a book. So while you might be able to get along, it doesn't mean that you will necessarily have bonds of friendship with, mm-hmm, and so forth. We need to accept those differences, don't we?
Well, I think so. And as you go through that conflict process, that, you know, the DESCA, when you get to those solutions, that's where you sort of start to tweeze out, we're quite different personalities, or we have different set of needs or different things that we like to do. Where are commonalities? How do we engage that? But then there's things that we're, you know, I'm a beach person. I'm not a mountain person or a hunter person. So there's times where maybe you do that with other people or other friends or other relatives, and I go to the beach with, mm-hmm, you know, other relatives. And that's part of the solution process that we're able to discern as we put all our stuff out on the table in an appropriate kind of way.
Yeah.
Okay. So how do we maintain our mental well-being in the face of conflict that we have tried to reconcile, but the person that we've tried to reconcile with is unreconcilable. And it's not a person that we can flee. For instance, it's not a boss we can go to a new job. It's someone in the family. And while we may be able to set some boundaries, there's constant re-engagements mm-hmm. because of events.
Yep.
How do we maintain our wellness when that person is snippy, critical, hostile, around the table? I'd prefer not to have the Brussels sprouts. They'll say snippy things about you, make you look stupid, or try to make you look. I mean, these types of negatives, I think most of us have had experience with somebody who is really judgmental or critical, and it's just not reconcilable. How do we maintain our wellness in the face of members of the family who are particularly conflictual and continue that?
Yep. I think this has to do with boundaries, not in the sense of controlling other people or telling other people to do or not do something, but in the sense that you know where you end and someone else starts. So their problems, what they say, being able to differentiate that this doesn't actually have anything to do with me. I have the capacity and ability to be okay, be present, and let it kind of roll off. And so I think that's when you have a solidified identity, sense of self, and security, you can observe these things, observe the comments, and say, wow, that kind of hurt my feelings. I didn't like that. But I know that has nothing to do with me, and I'm going to not let this take away from my time with my family.
Do you know, you just described a principle that Jesus taught. From the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. The good man brings forth good, out of the good stored up in him. The evil man brings forth evil, of the evil stored up. And this is a principle. The artist brings forth art, out of the art stored up in her. The musician brings forth music. The mathematician brings forth math. It's just a principle that other people's behaviors, actions, show their way of thinking, feeling, attitudes. So when other people criticizing you, they're actually telling you something about them.
Yep.
Isn't that true?
Projecting, yeah.
And now they may have pieces of truth in it, okay? It may have pieces of truth in it, but that's where insecure people, for instance, let's say somebody's obese and a member of the family who's this, contrarian, every time they're around will make some comment about their weight in a negative way.
Mm-hmm.
The person who's obese and not confident in themselves will not hear that as, this person has issues. They'll take that to heart and they'll feel just put down. They'll feel terrible because they're already uncomfortable with that. So it's like having a sunburn and somebody touches it. You're just, okay.
Yeah.
But the person who doesn't have a sunburn, somebody touches you, you go, what were you touching me for? Mm-hmm. The person who's at peace with themselves, that gets what's going on with you? You would have to say that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So for me, I look at it as needs and wants. And we can want a lot of things, but we don't really need a lot of things. So we need food, water, oxygen, house, God. We have a lot of wants in our life, but we oftentimes put wants in the category of needs. So whenever we put them in the category of needs, we sort of tell ourselves that I need that, or I'm dependent on that to deliver X, peace, joy, identity, importance, whatever. So I need that person's approval, or I need them to say nice things, or I need their reconciliation with me in order to be at peace or to be a good person. Well, I can want them to do that, but if they do or don't, that doesn't determine whether I'm going to have joy or peace or contentment or purpose or identity or all those really cool things that we desire. And I think people have a hard time of differentiating, like you said, sort of that boundary of, is that in the wants category or is that in the needs category? And we unfortunately put a lot of things in the needs category. That my relationship with you, well, it can only hold like 3 eggs. But if I put like 10 eggs in that basket, it's going to break.
Mm-hmm. I really like what you're saying there. Really like it. I'm going to take that and just kind of restate it in a subtle different way, because what you said is so true. If I'm trying to get that need from that, then I'm very vulnerable to their criticisms or their negativity, and I'm always working on them to get them to change. But
because I can't access X unless I get that.
So you put it needs, wants. I like that. It's also, we could frame that same dynamic under boundaries. what I'm responsible for, what I'm not responsible for. Yeah. I'm responsible for governance of myself, the decisions I make. I'm actually not responsible for what other people think or feel about me. Mm-hmm. And we could put it in another context, what I could describe the law of liberty. Mm-hmm. And the law of liberty, the idea of freedom, applying it to the self and see when the not wants, needs, they're actually breaching the law of liberty. Because the law of liberty says, I give other people freedom to think whatever they want. Where the needs things, I'm not giving them freedom. I'm wanting to control. I'm wanting to do something to manipulate their opinion of me to get what I need from them. So I'm not actually leaving them free to not like me. But the law of liberty, I'm going to apply that to myself. I'm going to give them freedom. If they want to think ugly things about me, they're free to do that. And if you really give them that freedom on an emotional level, you've actually just freed yourself from being hurt by them.
Mm-hmm.
It's really powerful.
But you have to make that connection to do that, because a lot of people think that I've given them freedom, but I'm still sad or angry, or I don't have a sense of self or sense of identity and purpose because I'm still needing their approval to get that. So there's overlap, but differentiation of those concepts.
Right. But the freedom really applied to the heart, not just the head, where I don't need that from them.
Correct.
Yeah. And that's freedom from truth, too. Yes.
Yep. And another part of that is if you don't know who you are, if you don't have really much of an identity, you're looking at external sources to tell you who you are. And so you're going to be a lot more sensitive to what people say and maybe incorporate that into how you view yourself. So you also have to be solid in who you are.
Now, let's put this out on the table. Christian, okay? Mm-hmm. Is it okay for a Christian family at a family gathering like Thanksgiving or Christmas to tell a family member they're not invited if that family member has a track record of grossly inappropriate and disruptive and emotionally harmful behavior over the course of time?
Yeah, I would say yes.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the reason I put Christian is because in my scenario, in my mind, that when you do that, the accusation, I thought you were a Christian. We're celebrating the birth of Jesus. We're giving thanks for the blessings. And I want to come celebrate Christ with you and you won't let me come.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, Jesus is the Prince of Peace. And when the rich young ruler wanted to follow him, he said, oh, well, that's great. I'd love you to follow me. It's very easy. You only have to do one thing. Well, what is that? We'll just give up all your stuff. Well, that person went away without peace. But, you know, Jesus set that boundary. Hey, look, here's what I need to see happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, being able to set that boundary, being able to, is that behavior, because I need to steward my home and the other people that I'm inviting, right? And if I know that this person is caustic or toxic to that environment, I'm not loving these other people very well in that process. And I'm not really loving that individual.
That's right.
Because I'm condoning their behavior or allowing them or enabling dysfunctional behavior. And not, it's sort of like when we excommunicate somebody, right? We don't really want to excommunicate somebody from the church. We want them to come to church more when they're, you know, but I also have a responsibility to protect the rest of the congregation from that behavior, as well as to show him how serious that behavior is, that it's endangering him and the rest of us.
Use the word toxic. I love it. Help our audience understand, because where I see a lot of people fall in the conflict is that the person is toxic. They are unhealthy. They bring an unhealthy atmosphere. However,
toxic meaning that they're contaminating others.
Right.
So it's not just them.
Right.
They're not just coming in a bubble.
Right.
But unfortunately, they're contaminating. They're getting their germs.
Right.
Even though
I'm going to use a metaphor on that in just a second. But the reason there's this tension on the person's ability to say no is because it's incited certain feelings of dislike in the person. I don't like them. They make me mad. And then they're in a Christian ethos struggle in themselves.
Are you saying the host is
the host? The host, yeah. Okay. I'm angry. This family member makes me mad. I'm angry. And I need to forgive. And they're in their internal struggle to not be resentful. And therefore, in that struggle to be Christ-like, they keep allowing them to come back because they don't want to make the decision based on their anger or resentment. Okay. And that's where they're focusing in the wrong place. The focus is not the keeping them out because you're angry and resentful. You're keeping them out because they're toxic. And so I use this metaphor. And the metaphor is imagining this loved one, this family member, works for the city sewer system. And they and they've had one of those like suits on, they've been in the sewer all day, and they come to your house, knock on the door, you open the door, and they're in their suit. They haven't changed and they're covered in feces. And they want to come in and sit down at your table and eat dinner with you. Would you let them in? No, you would say something, I'd love for you to join us for the meal, but you need to go home and clean yourself up first. And that's where you set the boundary of this. You need to take care and manage your stuff so that you come, you're not creating a toxic emotional world and atmosphere. And we'd love to have you when you can do that.
And that host too can have righteous anger
mm-hmm.
still. They can have, not necessarily in that sewer scenario, but in the other situation with that toxic, they can have righteous anger. They can forgive that person and forgiven some of their infractions.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that we've forgotten and that we're trusting fully for them to conduct themselves in an appropriate way for the health and enjoyment of the rest of the people that are invited to the party.
Right? That analogy that I give is really helpful to all our people. They can see now, okay, yeah, it's not about me being angry or me not being loving or me not being Christ-like. They are really, they create a foul atmosphere when they come here. The whole demeanor of the whole room changes. Nobody has any, I mean, everybody's just on edge. It ruins everything for this. There are people that do this and it's healthy. It's healthy to and you can use that metaphor and say that to them. And we'd love for you to come clean up, deal with your stuff.
Well, sometimes too, the person invites, the host will invite that toxic person either out of guilt or I want to bring them in so they can have a corrective experience.
It doesn't work.
But because of that toxic element and they don't have a mindset that's open to that, it isn't a corrective experience. In fact, it's even a reinforcing experience.
Because
those people are afraid and angry or they're placating or codependent. Or
often triggers some type of an outburst or conflict.
Yep.
The Christmas tree gets thrown over.
Yeah.
And, you know,
yeah.
People yell and say things they shouldn't be saying.
Yeah.
You know, all that does. Yeah.
Yep. And then they leave and they leave reinforced with all their biases and negativity and so forth and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah. So maintaining our peace and what we just described in the scenario was a internal boundary of recognizing and applying truth. There are sometimes people who are not open to healing, health, reconciliation. They are toxic people. And the normal response, if somebody, you know, stomps on your foot, it's normal to feel pain. It would be abnormal not to feel pain.
That's a good warning sign.
Yeah, exactly. And so to have a repulsed reaction to toxic behavior and be uncomfortable, even be hurt by it, is normal. And then what's the healthy response to that? To put an end to it, to get your foot out from under the other person's foot, okay, and set some boundaries. And I think people should be empowered to do that in a loving way.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes they struggle because we have these misplaced dependencies. We're dependent on their affirmation. We're dependent on their being able to come over. We're dependent on other people's opinion of us. Oh, I'm a Christian, then I have to do this nice thing to be able to maintain my Christendom or my image management to other people. So there's all these misplaced dependencies where we're putting our dependence in the wrong place to get certain needs met. And how do we sort of disengage or analyze, well, why am I doing this? What is the motivation behind this? Is it a healthy motivation for me, a healthy motivation for the individual that's the toxic individual? And so we need to be able to examine a little bit better rather than just go based on feelings. How do we bring reason into that and even bring counsel from others? Hey, let me run this situation by you. Let me, you know, I'm too much in the middle of it. It's hard for me to see it clearly because I get so emotional and wrapped up. You know, let me ask my counselor. Let me ask my spouse. Let me ask somebody else who's a little bit, you know, one or two steps removed from it and allow them to have reason or counsel that have that intellectual capacity or that intelligence that can override my emotional drive in it.
So we've talked about differences in like marriage relationships and family members and how to navigate and have honesty and I like the DESCA toolkit there to work through. We've talked about dealing with somebody who's toxic and you can't reconcile with. In closing and wrapping up, the idea when it's not a toxic person and it's not somebody we're going to reconcile, we're not going to reconcile, the idea of agreeing to disagree. With people who are not toxic, we may have some conflict. We can still love. We can still get along. We can still cherish. We can still value. And we can agree to disagree. Is there a place for that?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's part of you know, laying out the intention for a conversation, or even after a conflict, even after agreeing to disagree, restating your intention of, I care about you, you're valuable to me, and I don't see us agreeing on this topic right now, but, you know, maybe recognizing when the conversation itself is even moving into harmful.
You know, I got to tell you, sometimes that's very hard for me personally.
Yeah.
Because I tend to be a very objective, evidence-based, what I believe is a rational thinker who tries to think cause to effect, how things work, understand why they work. And for me, many of the things that I see and conclude are measurable, testable, reproducible, rational, and in my mind, provable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very difficult for me when I'm dealing with something like that and a person can't get it. And it's also difficult for me. And I really struggle to pray for God's grace. And I think of Jesus, how Jesus must have been frustrated with what I'll call our stupidity.
Yeah.
Okay. What he saw, what he understood, and how we didn't get it. And sometimes I lose patience and I lose grace sometimes when I'm dealing with people who may not be getting it. Okay. And it's so obvious to me. And that's something I have to work on and be more gracious. But I have this belief, and I've learned that it's wrong. My premise, my assumption was, well, you know, if you explain it well enough and you show the evidence well enough, anybody's going to understand it. And I've learned that no, there are some people who actually can't do math. They really just can't. It doesn't make sense to them. There are people, or at least a little bit of more than basic math, like algebra. They just like dyslexics. There's people who just can't get certain concepts. It just doesn't make sense to them. Okay. I have to learn that. I didn't initially know that. And so that bias or premise that I had would sometimes cause tension. And now it's like, okay, we already disagree.
Yeah.
I think everybody has smudges in their lenses. So nobody has a perfect godly perspective of situations. So trying to figure out, well, how can we be an agent that helps clean their lenses for them as you're presenting some things? And sometimes we can. And sometimes those lenses take 20, 30, 40 years. You know, I'm 62 years old. There's still parts of my lenses that I'm still working on getting out some of the smudges for. I think there's times where there's a right and a wrong, and there's a, okay, we're going to part our ways. And there's times where there's no right and wrong. There's just lack of chemistry or a lack of agreement in how we want this agenda to play out. So I see this a lot in people that leave a church, or they're not, sometimes they stay in a church even though it's not meeting their needs fully, but they're afraid to say, I'm going to leave the church even though it's not meeting, because I don't want to be in conflict or disagreement with them. Or that you have people that leave a church because whether they have children and they don't have other young children ministries in the church, or for whatever reason, there's no right or wrong. It's just what this church can deliver and what this family needs at the situation. And they part, but then they feel guilty or they feel bad that they had this tension about leaving when there was nothing really wrong that they were doing. They were in agreement with the theology and the things that they were teaching, but there were other needs that their family had that weren't being met that could be met by this other church down the line, even though there were a couple friends here. And, well, why are you leaving? And don't you like it here? And then the thing gets a lot more contaminated that it doesn't have to be. So being able to part ways and have some understanding or some communication about that, but to be okay that neither one is wrong. There's just a set of needs that you have. There's a set of things that you can supply, and it's not a match right now.
Well, I want to thank you all for joining us today. If you have conflict with people in your life, I think the DESCA tool is very helpful. But even before that, step back and inquire, what are my responsibilities? I have responsibilities for the decision I make in governance of myself, not for what other people think or how other people feel towards me. And then seek to have that understanding and comprehension from where the other person's coming from, open to being persuaded with good evidence and rationale that you can be moved if something is reasonable and appropriate. And then ultimately learning where, with discernment, people that are healthy or toxic, people that maybe need some boundary setting. And we hope this show was helpful for you. If you have questions, send those in to designformore.net, designformore.net, and we'll see you again next time. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on Designed for More, brought to you by Come and Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Also, don't forget to check out our other podcasts for more inspiring content.